Yeah. He'll be back at the next.
Thank you for being here today. I'm going to have the board members introduce ourselves, and then we'll let you introduce yourselves. We'll be together for about 40 minutes, allow you to make your presentation. We tend to ask questions and keep it more informal. We're hoping that you'll feel comfortable. This is a conversation back and forth, and we want this to be as stress-free as possible. So with that, I'll start with Jerry on my left. Oh, yes, thank you. He has to keep reminding me. This is a public meeting. We are having it taped. We need to have you release us from the confidentiality issues of this booklet.
Yes.
Thank you.
Jerry Holcomb, trustee.
Terry Buck, trustee.
John Phillips, trustee.
Carolyn Leadham, CEO. Maria Veramontes, chair and trustee.
Jerry Tellis, trustee.
Trustee Watts, trustee.
Deborah Allen, trustee.
Gabe Rodriguez, trustee.
Well, thank you so much for allowing us to meet with you today to present our private equity capabilities. My name is Trish Hunter, and I'm a member of the Institutional Client Group based here in San Francisco. And if we're hired, I would be your primary contact for BlackRock, the firm, and all of the strategies. So at the end of the table is Leo Chanet, and he works with private equity clients. And would be your day-to-day contact within the private equity group. And in the middle here, we've got Craig Payne and Steve Kelly, who are portfolio managers within the group, and they would be assigned to your particular account. BlackRock has a proven track record in managing private equity assets. We're focused on outperformance for our clients. And you don't have to take our word for it. We've actually included some client references in the back of the book on page 17, the majority of whom are public fund clients. We have worldwide resources and manage across a variety of market structures. And so we feel we're uniquely positioned to take advantage of opportunities in this difficult market environment. And we're committed to real asset space, as well as our partnership with public fund clients, which include both states and California county funds. I'll now pass it over to Leo to introduce our diversified private real asset strategy.
Thank you, Trish. On page 3, there's a summary of what we're offering today. And we took the liberty to put a name on it. You see on the top of the page there is a customized private real assets account that we would build together with the staff and with the folks from Norman. The objective here, obviously, is to beat your target for real assets private returns, which is the CPI plus 600. We've got a pretty darn good track record of doing that for our other clients. This is not a new type of business for us. We've been doing it for a while. We do it through a couple of commingled programs, and we also run a separate account for the AT&T pension, back on the East Coast. We also run a number of these types of accounts for some very large programs, state pension plan sponsors like yourselves. We've put some references in the back as well for you to. We encourage you to talk to these folks about us. A couple of things about how the separate account is different from a commingled program. There are a few where I guess I would describe bells and whistles that are very different. One, we offer all of our separate account clients what we call a no-fault divorce option in the industry, and that basically means you can fire us whenever you want. If you don't like what we're doing, you can basically unilaterally terminate the agreement. You cannot do that in a commingled fund. It's very, very difficult to do, so you have some unique optionality there. We also offer a suspension option. So say, for example, if the public markets went back to 800 in the S&P and you suddenly found your private allocation overweight relative to your overall portfolio, you can call us up and say, okay, we'd like to put the brakes on the investment period for 6 months or 9 months until things calm down in the broader market. So that's different. Again, something you can't do. Another feature, if you like, is that you can do an evergreen program. So rather than having to regularly go back and recommit new capital, what you can do is take the proceeds from these investments and reinvest them over time. So some things there that I think are important to point out. Trish mentioned, she introduced us, we are the dedicated team that would be focusing on this account. What I like to say is, you know, BlackRock's a big place, and we are the team that would kind of make BlackRock small for you, if you like. As Trish mentioned, she's the broader account manager for everything BlackRock. I would be the account manager for this particular strategy, handling everything non-investment related. And then Steve and Craig would be your dedicated portfolio managers, helping you ultimately to get to know the wider team. It's a big team. It's 34 investment professionals in the group. And you can see on the right-hand side, there is a high-touch service model we think that's also different. So we like to get to know staff. We like to make introductions to general partners. We share a lot of our research. We are very, very transparent, and Steve's going to talk a little bit to that as we go through the presentation. So it is a differentiated high-touch service model. We have shown some examples of our reporting, our thought pieces and research to the staff and the consultant as well, and I think they'd second that notion. Another important point that we are going to provide, obviously, access to great real assets opportunities, but more importantly, asset selection. So Craig is going to talk a little bit more specifically about the type of program we're going to build. And I think, to the asset selection point, we've done a great job generating strong returns for our clients in this space. Portfolio construction and due diligence is incredibly important. They are hallmarks of our business. And Craig will cover that a little bit in terms of the customized program that we intend to build for Contra Costa County. And then lastly, just in summary, we have what we believe is a very, very attractive fee proposal for you that we revised slightly following discussions with staff and the folks from Milliman last week, where we expect to eliminate this notion of the J-curve for the pensioners. So, and I think I'm going to just hand it back to Trish, who's going to give you a little bit more background on the broader BlackRock, and then we'll dive into the details here.
So I'm just going to quickly hit on the high points, because I'm sure that your consultant has provided you with a lot of information about BlackRock. BlackRock is an independent public company with no majority shareholders. We believe this aligns our interests with those of our clients. BlackRock was founded on principles of risk management, and that core value underscores everything that we do today for our clients. And finally, BlackRock is a global firm with investment offices in 22 countries around the world. And we believe this provides us with local market insights that actually benefit our clients. So on to Steve, and we'll talk about the portfolio.
Thanks. Questions at this point before we go into a little bit of background on the team and our strategy and our approach? Great. So my name is Steve Kelly. And I'll talk to you a little bit about the history of our team and our capabilities and our approach to building a real assets portfolio for you. I'm on page 5 right now. Our real assets capabilities are an integral part of our overall private markets investment team, which we call, you might hear us refer to this throughout the presentation, private equity partners, PEP, PEP, but it's sort of core to our overall investment team is the real assets experience here. I helped start this business with a gentleman by the name of Russ Steenberg back in 1999, so I've been with the team since its formation. And Russ's private markets investment history actually dates back to the 1980s. Russ helped start and build the private equity and real assets portfolio for AT&T's corporate pension fund. So he was back in the early days when there were really only four leading institutional investors in the asset class. It was GE, General Motors, IBM, and AT&T. So Russ's lineage goes way, way back to the earliest formations of both private equity and real assets investing. I think you'll see if you stack us up against the other folks that have been in today, we have a very, very senior and experienced team. If you look at just the managing directors on the investment team, we average more than 20 years of private equity, real asset, and related experience. We have 34 investment professionals around the globe right now, and our assets under management related to private equity and real assets is about a little more than $15 billion. Importantly, $850 million of that is dedicated capital targeting a real assets strategy. And we'll show you in the end, actual detail for you, every real assets investment we've made as part of this team for the last about 6-7 years. It's also important to note that at BlackRock, it's a philosophy of the firm and it's a philosophy of our team, of my team, that we put our money where our mouth is. We invest in all of our products alongside our clients, side by side. Of the $15 billion that we have committed so far, $500 million of that is BlackRock capital and employee capital. I have my children's college funds invested in my products. I better perform or my kids are not going to college. They're going to go get a trade, which wouldn't be bad either. And we sit side by side with our clients, and when capital calls go out, I write checks as well to go into those investments. And it's a very interesting dynamic when you're making investment decisions and you're sitting around an investment committee deciding what's going to go into a portfolio to remember that when that goes into the portfolio, you're going to write a check for your pro rata piece of that. It's a very, very powerful, powerful motivator. We move to page 6. As the world's largest asset management firm, we think that we have an information advantage, a unique information advantage that probably isn't matched by anyone else in the industry when it comes to sourcing and diligencing real asset and private equity investments. There are multiple layers to this information advantage that we think we have, and it starts with our team. Across the 34 investment professionals that we have a collective network of relationships that, again, date back nearly 30 years. This is a relationship business. It's really, really important to know who the players are, and it's not something that you can just step in and start from scratch and say, here we are, we're a real asset player, and we know everybody. It's relationships matter. We surround that with our network of general partners and sponsors. Again, having done this for a long, long time, we have capital deployed with more than 370 general partners in private equity and real assets around the world. It is a huge, huge network that we draw upon, again, when we're looking for investment opportunities and when we're diligencing them. All of this is complemented by the broader global BlackRock platform, where we have more than 200 research analysts and nearly 500 portfolio managers running different strategies in equities and fixed income and alternatives around the globe. It may sound a little trite, but we like to tell people there isn't a region, a country, an industry, and in many cases, a company or a management team that we're not a phone call away from when we need to talk to somebody. We have folks around the world. We were looking at an Indonesian cable deal about 6 or 8 months ago, and wouldn't you know, we have folks that are on the ground managing capital in Indonesia, not only knew the industry, knew the macro, but actually knew the company, and were able to give us detailed diligence on a single phone call. We don't think that that can be replicated by any other group that has come in here today. As Leo said, we work very hard every day to deliver the resources, the scale, and the information advantage of a huge global asset management firm, but with the client service, transparency, and responsiveness of a boutique. That's what we try and do. Page 7, again, this highlights in a little bit more detail our investment team, our senior investment team of directors and managing directors. Very, very experienced. Again, with our senior partners having averaging more than 20 years of private equity, real assets, and related experience. Again, as we mentioned, it's very much a relationship business, in particular in real assets, where the opportunity set for investable institutional opportunities is still developing, and it's all about knowing who is institutional, who is investable, as the market continues to develop. Deep domain knowledge and a variety of backgrounds is key to our team. We have folks that have direct investment experience, corporate finance experience, M&A experience, consulting experience, high yield experience, and credit backgrounds, all of which help provide a diversified view when we're looking at sourcing and diligencing general partners and other investment opportunities. We also have broad geographic coverage as well, with teams that are focused in the Americas, in Europe, and in Asia. Page 8, everybody has a process. Sue Carter has a great process. She runs a great, great shop, and guess what? We have a process, too. Two things that I would tell you about our process that we think are differentiators. One, we really try to run an institutional, transparent process. This is not a black box. If you award us a mandate, we will not go back to our offices, put our heads down, come up with a bunch of investment opportunities and show up 6, 12, 18 months later and say, guess what, here's your portfolio. We run an iterative process. It's open. We like to involve staff to the extent that they are interested in doing so that You know what's going into your portfolio. It's also rooted in risk management. So again, by being transparent and trying to identify those risks that put clients' capital at risk is a hallmark of what we try and do. It's all about focus, being focused on downside protection and being transparent. We also have something that we think is unique for a very, very large firm. We have what we call a two-step investment process. We have a standard investment committee like everybody else has an investment committee. Here, it's down in the bottom, called the Internal Investment Committee. That's basically all the managing directors on the investment team. We get together and we do all of the approvals to decide to put any investment opportunity into a particular client's portfolio. The second step, though, which is unique to us, is we involve senior BlackRock folks who are external to our team. We call it the External Investment Committee. It's external to private equity partners, but it's internal to BlackRock, to look over our shoulder. We think it's fundamentally good governance. We think it prevents us from drinking our own Kool-Aid. And as I said, since we manage $500 million of the firm's capital and employees' capital, it gives them an opportunity to opine on what's going into those portfolios as well. These folks are very senior. It is the president of the firm, Rob Capito. It is a vice chairman of the firm in Ken Wilson. Russ is on it as well. Matt Botine, who runs all of the alternatives business at BlackRock, is on it. You'd be amazed at how much these folks are able to free up on a moment's notice their time to participate. They're all active. And I will tell you, you cannot BS your way through the president of the firm. Better have your I's dotted and your T's crossed. So we think it's very, very good governance, and it's worked very well for us. And we've done this for 13 years, and we will continue to do it going forward. It's a great, great mechanism for us and for our clients. I'll turn it to Craig to talk specifically about the investment strategy that we're proposing.
Sure. And my name is Craig Payne. Good morning. I'm an investment professional on the team, and I focus a lot of my time on the real assets portion of our business, and this would be one of my primary tasks, managing your money going forward. I'll take you through pages 9 through 12, and this is really going to give you a sense as to how we view the real assets universe, and most importantly, how we would envision structuring your real assets portfolio, building it from the ground up. Just quickly on page 9, this gives you a listing of the different investment categories that we see as being most important in the real asset space. And importantly, these are asset categories that we think are going to give you inflation protection, an element of cash and interim yield, and also that we think can generate returns in excess of your CPI plus 6% target returns. So I'll get into in a couple of pages into some of the specifics of how this portfolio is going to look. But the key takeaway here is that we think energy and infrastructure in particular, and to a lesser extent timber mining and agriculture, these are the pieces of the real assets universe that are critical to building your portfolio from scratch. And I'll talk about why that is in over the next couple of pages. If you go to page 10, this just gives you a snapshot of what we've done in the real asset space. A couple of things that I'll highlight. As Steve mentioned, we manage over $500 million of committed capital in vehicles focused solely on the real asset space. So the real asset space is important to us, and we manage existing vehicles focused purely on real assets. On top of that, today we manage north of close to $900 million across roughly 40 different investments in the real asset space. So these are both investments in our dedicated pools of capital and also in our generalist pools of capital. So again, real assets is something that we focus on a lot, and we manage a lot of existing capital investments today. And what you'll see in a couple of pages, we've got lots of detail that was referred to earlier. You'll see that the performance of this portfolio is really positive, and it shows you that we'll be able to get to the CPI plus 6% and exceed it that you're looking for. Net returns today are north of 15% on our real assets investment, so we feel very good about our progress. Flipping to pages 11 and 12, I think 11 is the most important slide that I'll talk to, and this really gives you a sense as to how we think about structuring a real assets portfolio for you from the ground up. And this is based on a number of things. Where we see the best risk-adjusted return opportunities over the investment horizon of 3 to 4 years, where we see the deepest pool of manager talent, and we think that investing in the best managers, irrespective of the industries that they're focused on, is critical to sustainable positive returns. We think these areas are important in terms of generating an element of current income, and again, to getting to and exceeding our CPI plus 6% hurdle. In terms of specifics, you see the pie charts on the far left investment strategy. We think having energy and infrastructure as the core pieces of this portfolio is important, and again, to a lesser extent, having exposure to agriculture, mining, and timber. Part of that is just where we see the market opportunities today, the capital need, both today and over the next 3 or 4 years in energy and infrastructure are tremendous. There are a lot of opportunities out there. We also think this is where the deepest pool of qualified institutional managers are. So we think those should be the pillars of the portfolio.
Question.
Sure.
On this allocation here, would you explain whether there are more upstream, midstream, downstream, and specifically on energy and infrastructure, what exactly are you looking at, oil, minerals?
Sure. So why don't I take you quickly to page 12, and we'll come back to page 11. But this gives you a sense as to how we think about the different categories. What you'll see in here for energy is that we really focus up and down the food chain, the value chain in the energy space. So we've done a lot in upstream. We've done a lot in midstream. We've done a fair amount in the power space and oil field services and equipment. You know, our view is that, number one, as Steve mentioned, we're ultra-focused on downside protection. So the most important thing is not just the piece of the value chain you're in, but making sure that your downside is protected with that particular investment. That can be, you know, revenue streams, contracts, et cetera, lots of ways to do that. But that's the number one thing for us. The capital opportunity in that chain is very significant, and it's most significant today in the upstream and the midstream space. That's where we've been spending most of our time. You know, what we see in the market is there's a tremendous amount of need for drilling capital today. You know, you see numbers, you know, north of $500 billion over the next, you know, 10, 15 years in the U.S. alone. We also think there's, because of that, there's going to be a tremendous need for midstream infrastructure, gathering, processing, LNG export, things like that. That's yet to really hit everyone's radar because most of the energy market's time and attention is focused on finding the oil and gas today. That next step is going to be getting that oil and gas, processing it, and getting it to market. So we think those two pieces of the value chain are going to be critical over the investment horizon, but we're always looking up and down the value chain. And then and to your question about mining and minerals, you know, that focuses into the second last category here. We think that's an important space. You know, for a number of reasons, particularly growth in the emerging markets. You know, they're driving a tremendous need for minerals, and also there's a real lack of capital available for project developers in the mining space today. So we think there's a real opportunity to go in there to get a senior financial position in these companies at a really good valuation and with downside protection. So it's an area that we focus on, but we also know that it's a risky area. There's a lot of development stage risk there, and there's also a much smaller pool of managers that are really well qualified in the mining space. So it's an area that we focus on, but we're cautious about. So just going back to page 11 to finish the discussion there, investment type. You know, primary funds, investing in funds and allocating to funds, that would be the primary focus as we build your portfolio. Geographically, you know, we will be global, but we will primarily target managers that focus on North America, that have a globally focused strategy, and that target Europe. Part of that is because of the focus on both energy and infrastructure. We think Europe, North America are the biggest, and North and South America are the biggest potential markets for energy and infrastructure over the next 3 to 4 years. And also we're downside protection focused. We have a stronger preference for OECD company or country risk as opposed to, you know, areas with geopolitical risk. So we'll tend to focus on developed markets in North America, South America, and Europe. And then lastly, vintage year. We think vintage year diversification is important. We've shown here that roughly we would try to allocate capital over 3 years. I could foresee a scenario where we may look to do it over 4 years, not only to make sure we're getting the full market cycle, but also getting access to a couple of managers that are very special managers and making sure that we're meeting their fundraising cycle. And so what that translates into this last bullet here is We envision a portfolio of somewhere between 15 and 25 investments. You know, our own internal research, academic research shows your optimal amount of diversification is in that high teens, low 20s area. And we also think that's the right number to get these allocations to the different industry verticals that we've talked about.
Greg, could you talk a little bit about secondaries and co-investment as primary versus secondary, how they've compared in your experience with primary investments directly with managers?
Sure.
In a normal way, and whether you seek to find those or you use them opportunistically?
Yeah, it's somewhere in between. You know, primary fund investing is definitely our core focus. We think you need to have a strong primary program to drive things like co-investment and secondary activity. You have to know the GPs, have those relationships, and have worked with them to even be able to look at secondaries and co-investments. So we think that's the primary piece of this portfolio. We do opportunistically look at co-investments and secondaries. Co-investments are a meaningful part of our business. Today we've got north of 50 total co-investments that we manage, around $1 billion of commitments, a little bit north of that. So co-investments are important, and those are a valuable tool. They can be a valuable tool for a couple of reasons. One, again, to Leo's point, it can help mitigate the J-curve. You can get the capital to work immediately, and we always invest on a no-fee, no-carry basis. So there's absolutely no fees or carries that we're paying to our general partners that we co-invest with. So that helps flatten the J-curve. The other valuable piece in co-investing is it's a great diligence tool for doing manager selection. So, for example, we looked at a co-invest earlier this year in a container terminals business. So this is ports where container ships drop off their containers and then they're processed from there. And that was with a GP that we know. And looking at that deal helps us do a great level of diligence on the general partner who did that deal. So the next time they come to raise money, we've worked alongside them. We know how they think about businesses. Really valuable tool. Secondaries, we have a team dedicated to secondaries. It's something that we have a focus on, but we are more opportunistic. I would say we're not a traditional big secondary buyer. We're investing for primary fund-like returns. So we're not generally not focused on broadly syndicated auctions. We're looking for, you know, high teens, low 20s type returns. And again, they can help flatten the J-curve. And to your point about performance, as you dig deeper, what you see is the investments that we've made in the co-invest space can be very valuable from a performance perspective. You look at them on a public market equivalent basis, whereas funds, you may get a 500 to 600 basis point premium historically relative to the public markets. Our co-invest portfolio have been more in the 1,000 to 1,100 basis point premium. So co-investments are also very additive from a return perspective.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's page 11, and then I'll go to page 12 quickly. And what this is here is a model portfolio that we've built for Contra Costa County, and it includes specific funds that we expect to be available over the next 3 to 4 years, the investment cycle, and that meet the allocation and diversification targets that we've laid out here. So there's a lot of detail here. What I'd really hope you would take away from this is that we've put a meaningful amount of thought into constructing a portfolio, both in terms of portfolio allocations and specific managers over the investment horizon of this vehicle that would go into this portfolio. And not only have we put a lot of thought into it, but we've got the relationships and the knowledge of the market to select the best managers. Also, I'll highlight the fact that, you know, we've helped other clients, as Leo talked about, build their real assets program from the bottoms up. AT&T is a great example in the energy space. We're doing it right now with the Alaska Permanent Fund in the infrastructure space. So other clients have trusted their time and money with us to help them build up a real assets platform. So we feel like we've got that track record. We're very confident we could build this for you in a really positive way. We would love to work with you. We think this could be a really great partnership, and we hope that that you will consider us to be your partner.
Could you share a little bit about the agricultural investments in this portfolio? They're not groups I'm familiar with.
Sure. So there's a range. So agriculture, I would say, has the smallest pool of investable institutional quality managers of all of these categories. It's an emerging space. It's not a space with a long track record. What you see out there is a range. Groups like Tays River, for example, this is a group, it's a farmland manager, but they also move up and down the agricultural food chain, so they'll do processing, they'll do logistics, they'll do the midstream of agriculture. So it's not just going out there and buying farmland, it's owning and operating farms and the various pieces of the value chain that go into that. So that's one flavor. You have a group like NCH Agribusiness, very different, whereas Tays River is purely domestically focused. NCH is more European focused. They look to for opportunities in Ukraine and Russia. Very different risk-return opportunity. I'd say higher risk, higher return opportunity. It's an area, Russia and Ukraine, where land prices are much more attractive than they are here in the U.S. U.S. has become very competitive on an acreage acquisition price basis. So less competitive there, very fertile soil, but the challenges are political. You know, rule of law is questionable, regulatory. It's a very fragmented market. You've got a lot of very small farms, and consolidating ownership of that is not easy. So that just kind of gives you a sense as to the range. Again, I think this would be an up, you can see this is an up to 10% piece of the category. We would be very careful about names that we put in there. But the I would say this would be one of the areas of the portfolio that would be a valuable source of yield, both in terms of a farm land ownership, farm ownership, and farm operations strategy. Terry.
And on the infrastructure, what type of infrastructure would you be looking at with these?
Sure. So we have a dedicated infrastructure investment team at BlackRock. That's two of the three pools of dedicated real assets capital that I mentioned earlier. It's a primary fund focused group, and the bias is really towards core and value added infrastructure. And what that means is you're really focused on the lower risk, also lower return, but lower risk, more yield focused infrastructure. Here we put some groups in here that we know well, that we've invested with, that would get you access to not only those core types of projects, but different geographies. So for example, Brookfield is a group that we're about to close on an investment with confidentially. This is a group that has really good South American capabilities team. That's very rare in the infrastructure space, not a lot of groups that do South America very well. EQT, on the flip side, is a European-based group. They focus two-thirds of their capital on continental Europe and Scandinavia. It's a family-founded business, the Wallenberg family based in Stockholm. It's a very relationship-driven deal sourcing model. So because of the Wallenberg family, because of the legacy of working with European family businesses, they're able to get really unique deal flow with very strong downside protection.
Would you consider, when you said core infrastructure, would you consider that more of a long-term investment? And if so, when would you get out of it then? Because at some point we're going to get out of it. This isn't an office building that we want to own for 50 years.
That's right.
So how would the core work in something like this then?
Yeah, we core can be long-term, and some of them can be very long-term, 15, 20-year investment funds. That's generally not what we're going to do. When we refer to core, we think of it more in terms of the risk profile. Generally, it has to do with the contractual nature of the businesses. Are there offtake contracts? Is it a de facto monopoly because you have a single client? You can still have shorter-term investment horizons. EQT, for example, generally is looking to exit businesses within a 4 to 6 year period, but we still consider most of what they do to be core because it's got that downside protection characteristics. So we're obviously conscious of the investment horizon of the vehicle.
In most of these underlying funds, they're all closed-end funds, typically 10-year partnerships, so they're not 20- and 30-year life funds where they can just decide to hold them. They have to dispose of them at some time.
Yeah, those exist, but that's not what we've included here.
You made a reference to lower returns in the infrastructure space. What kind of returns are you expecting, and would you be putting leverage on that?
So we would not put any leverage at the Contra Costa County vehicle level. Any leverage that's applied is applied at the underlying investment level. Core returns can be anywhere from high single digits net, so call it 8, 9, 10%, up to 11, 12%. So I'd say it's a fairly narrow band, high single digit to low double digit. Now, you can get some different flavors of core that may get you to mid-teens That can be through combination of investing in slightly earlier stage assets. Maybe you're buying power plants that are not that are merchant, so they're selling power into the spot market as opposed to contracted assets. But there's a line of sight to get it to a lower risk profile. But in general, think of it as 8-12 type percent returns.
So to get your overall target, you can't use too much of that.
That's right.
Find some very high returns somewhere.
Yeah, it's a combination of portfolio allocation. So infrastructure will be up to 40%. You can also have a mix within infrastructure of pure core versus core plus or value added. You know, it's a gray area how you define a manager, but you think of it in terms of both the risk level of risk and their target return levels. So there will be a mix. It will not just be 8-10% type return funds.
So you're talking about infrastructure. You're talking about things like roads, where you have tolls, toll roads, and then so you have some stream of income along with build out.
It varies. It's across the board.
Okay.
The way we really think about it, EQT is a good example, is how secure the cash flows. Toll roads, for example, it's a toll road business. It's based on the number of cars that go through and the rate that you charge. So you don't have certainty as to how many cars are going to come through every day. But what we focus on is how certain are those cash flows. Are there any alternate routes, for example, for those drivers? If that's the only way they can go, and they can't substitute trains or buses for cars, we take that into consideration as to how we think about downside protection.
San Francisco Bridge, unless you're going on BART.
That's right. So, we're not looking for, we're generally not looking for greenfield, very early stage risk. We're looking for certainty of cash flow, whether it be purely contractual or, quasi-monopolies, if you like.
When you say on your page 12, North American and global are the green ones, but I think you mentioned that EQT was Europe.
Yes.
Correct.
Two-thirds of what they do is in Europe. Yes.
Okay. So that one's kind of a mixture.
It's global.
So the blue ones are all Europe. Is that
the blue ones are primarily Europe focused?
Okay.
For high, as an example, High Tech Vision. That's a group based in Norway. They focus on upstream and midstream oil field services companies based in Europe and serving European markets.
So overall, the example you've put together here, how much of that is actually in the U.S.?
The underlying investments, focus.
Of the funds. I don't know if you've analyzed what percentage of each fund is in the U.S. Are they all sort of spread out in globally?
Every manager is a little bit different. So you're going to have some managers that are based in the U.S. and they're only investing in U.S. companies. Then you're going to have groups like EQT. Their team is based in Stockholm, it's based in Zurich, and it's based in Connecticut. And they're allocating capital to Europe and to the U.S. So there's lots of different flavors. The way that we think about it is, back on page 11, we think about it, at a high level, where are these groups focused? Are they global? Are they just North America? Are they just Europe? And then you can look at it on an underlying basis. That's harder to do up front because you will generally get guidelines, kind of like what we've given you here. They'll say, EQT will say, okay, we'll target up to 40% in the U.S. And it could be 20%, it could be 40%, just based on the opportunity. So you never really know, but you have a good sense. But in general, particularly in energy and infrastructure, most of the exposure you would have in this portfolio is going to be in North America, Europe, and some in South America. That's the way I would think about it.
You have a maximum of 75% U.S. What would be the minimum that we might expect?
That's a good question. I would say my guess is it's probably going to be somewhere in the 45-75% range. It's going to be very meaningful. Part of that is because of energy. You see, energy is very green here, and most of those energy names, green is North American global, most of these energy names are U.S. focused, North America focused. I would say that North America is going to be the biggest piece of this portfolio.
I'm curious, just a curious question about the timber. Is it primarily old growth, or is it renewable, or is it a mix of both, or which way is that going?
It's a mix of both. So timber, as you might have heard from others, has been hit pretty hard the last 10 years. Part of that is just due to the housing cycle and the economy in the U.S. So the housing, particularly for U.S.-focused funds, is a big driver of how they have done. But the emerging theme here is I guess there's two. One, the housing market starting to recover, so you see new housing starts. That generally seems like we're going in the good direction for our vehicle here. And the other part is just the emerging market story. Asia, China in particular, just a tremendous amount of construction going on. So the demand for softwoods, which is mostly what's used in construction, is really rising. So those are the two big themes. And then the other part of the theme there is where you actually grow it. So you can grow softwoods in the southern U.S., but you know it's also there's a big potential market in Brazil, for example, where the climate is very supportive of that. You can grow eucalyptus in 18-month cycles, so you can turn it very fast, and your logistics, your costs of shipping it to Asia and other developing markets can be lower. So there's a lot of different themes in there. But I would say for timber, for the most part, we're going to be focused on North American based and focused GPs, South American, and to a lesser extent, I'd say Southeast Asia, Australia, feeding up into the Asian markets.
But there is some of it is renewable forest growth.
Oh, yes.
Is what we're talking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are different strategies. You have some guys who just go in and they will buy large parcels of lands, and it's hardwoods, and they will look to time the market cycle and harvest it when it makes sense. There will be other groups where it's, like in Brazil, you're replanting every 18 months, and it's all about cycling and replanting and regrowing.
Your portfolio, as you presented it versus the others that we've interviewed today, you have more co-investment vehicles than the others do. And that's a really marked difference. So explain to me, have you had an experience where you need to exit a co-investment, and what is that process that you go through to make that decision, and then who makes it? Is it similar to your investment decision to go back to the same group, or it's someone else? Just
sure.
Walk us through that. That's my first question. The last one is, you're a large company, but you presented the boutique style of this particular asset class within your large company. So answer the question on key person risk, key man risk. Are you going to remain with us as a group, as a team? You see changes coming up. We would like to know that.
Sure. Well, why don't we take the second question first?
Sure.
I guess the way that I think about it, I go back to the slide Steve touched on page 7. The way we built our team, and Steve can talk about this as one of the founding partners, the way we built the team is as a team of generalists with, I'd call them de facto specialties. So the good news is it's not Steve and I would be the face of the relationship with Contra Costa County, but there are lots of other people within our team that are focused on real assets and that would be working to structure portfolio. So I think you should feel good that it's not, if one person leaves, the strategy and the program falls apart. That's not the case at all. I've done a lot in the real asset space. Steve has. Serge is our head of infrastructure. In Zurich, Jerome, Francisco, Jay, Lynn, we've all done a lot in the real asset space. So I think you can feel good about that. And you look at the tenure of everybody who's involved here and who's really focused on real assets, we've all been around a long time. We've gone through hard times, through the 08 and 10 period. So the team has really stuck together. So I would feel good about that in your shoes.
We've had very little turnover.
So your exit plan when things go wrong.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Your exit plan when things go wrong.
Oh, for co-invest?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Can we take that one?
You've just been talking for a while.
Sure, please, go ahead. Go ahead, I'm dry.
So important to note, co-investments are not an afterthought to this business at all. In fact, when Russ and I started the business, we knew, Russ did a ton of co-investing at AT&T. It was a really, really important part of the business. We knew it was going to be an important part of the business, and we know it at an up to 30% allocation, it is differentiated from what other folks are offering. We built the team with people who know how to do direct investing. We taught them how to pick funds. It is very, very difficult to take a fund picker and rewire their DNA to be direct deal doers. It just doesn't work that way. We do, however, believe we are much better fund pickers because of our direct co-investing skill. If you look across our entire platform, this is a bit of a preamble, and then I'll come directly to your question. If you look across our entire platform, we have done nearly, we might have broken it now, 90 co-investments. It's more than $1 billion of invested capital over the last 13 years with a very, very strong track record. We have differentiated ourselves in the market as a group that understands how to do direct deals. We do an additional layer of diligence on top of what the sponsor provides us without getting in their way. Sponsors really only care about three things when they're doing a co-investment, when they're offering one, if we're going to co-invest alongside them: speed, certainty, and price. Can you get there by the time the deal closes without getting in my way as a sponsor? So do whatever you need to do, but don't derail my process. If you tell me you're going to get there, do you actually get there? Sponsors, the worst thing in the world for a sponsor is a protracted maybe. Maybe we're still looking at it. No, we're still looking at it. We're still looking at it. A quick no is infinitely better than a protracted maybe. And at closing, does your check clear? That's really all they care about. We have, for 13 years, we've been doing this, and we have a great reputation. This is one area where if you have any hesitation, call every one of our separate accounts and ask them anything and everything about those guys, BlackRock, the co-investing, a little bit nervous. Please tell me what you know about them. Call everybody on there, and they'll tell you what they think. When it comes down to exiting a co-investment by definition means we are a minority owner of a business. All of the work we do up front is to make sure that when we close and we wire our money, we are on the same terms and conditions, buying the same security at the same valuation on the same date as the sponsor, so that when the sponsor decides to exit a deal or do anything with that investment because it's good for them, it's good for us because we are completely aligned. The less we are aligned going into a deal, the less likely we are to do it. One classic example is a sponsor puts money into a deal at a certain cost basis. The company grows, they need more financing. They come to us and say, do you want to invest in this deal? It's at a higher valuation and a different cost basis. From the get-go, we are misaligned with them. Not to say we wouldn't get there. Sometimes we require them to put money into this round. Sometimes we structure around to get our capital out first. There are ways to get around it. But the less you are aligned going in, the less likely we are to do a deal, so we don't face the situation where we want to get out because it's good for us, but the sponsor doesn't because they're on different terms and different conditions. So that's a big, big piece of the diligence up front, is to make sure that we are aligned with our sponsors.
Great. Thank you. Yes, John.
Say, in follow-up to that, do you see any conflict of interest in investing in as co-investing, in that you conceivably could develop a relationship with the manager that caused you to be more willing to invest in them than you might otherwise, and perhaps others I haven't thought about?
It's a great question. We talk about it all the time. I will tell you this right now. I will never invest in a sponsor. We will never invest in a sponsor simply because they show us co-invests. We don't do that. In fact, we have invested with folks that have never shown us a co-invest. We would love to see co-investments from Hellman and Friedman and some other. They just don't do co-investing. It's just not core to their strategy. An LP commitment has to stand on its own. We would never put capital with a sponsor because we think they're going to feed us co-invests. And it's actually a segue into where I was going to go on monitoring, which is, once we invest with a general partner, we are out on the road in front of these people all the time. We have a view that you cannot, some people might, but we do not run our business sitting behind a computer screen in Princeton, in Zurich, in London, in Hong Kong, Boston, Chicago, whatever it happens to be. We are out on the road. My wife hates it. My kids hate it. At some point, they'll love it. But right now, and it's expressly because we need to be on top of those general partners to make sure the LP commitment is progressing. We are mining them for co-investments at that point, and we're also looking to mine secondary opportunities. It's very, very, I will tell you, co-investing is not in the top 10 list of things that a sponsor cares about. It just isn't. They've got other things going on. We want to be in front of them saying, hey, remember us? We do co-investing. We look for secondary, such that when it does break their top 10, they go, oh, yeah, the BlackRock guys. I need to call them. So it's proactive monitoring, getting out in front of them, and staying on top of the investments.
But the other angle on your question is every time we look at a co-investment, we always staff it in a way that you have nonpartisan people involved. So So I'm working on a Western Canada dry gas deal right now with a sponsor that I don't cover. And so part of the reason of that is I don't walk in there with a bias towards, you know, I'm in love with this sponsor, we got to do the deal. It's purely about, is this the right deal for us?
We do the same thing when we send trustees to go see you. We have a balance of trustees that go, some that may not have voted for you on every trip.
Exactly.
Okay, Gabe, would you have a question?
Yeah, just looking at some, Millman put together a report and some judgments, and there's one in October of last year that was a violation of Title I of the ERISA. Are you familiar with that one?
Against us? Against BlackRock?
If I'm reading it right, yeah.
What page are you on there?
I'm on page 22, second paragraph.
On October 3, 2012, BlackRock reached an agreement with the DOL to reimburse $2.6 million in connection with certain trades DOL alleged violated Title I of ERISA. I would assume that's some other part of BlackRock.
It is. So that's the legacy, it's the commingled vehicle portion of the business. So our indexing passive strategies, and there, I think what we found is there was no intentional wrongdoing, and it was a small part of the business.
There is no litigation that I'm aware of against our business, private equity, real assets inside of BlackRock. There's none.
Gabe, without knowing anything more than what's here, it sounds like a prohibited transaction. I'm just guessing. Prohibited transactions get very hazy as to, I had to deal with these quite a bit, as to quite what they are and whether or not you're in that. So given the dollar magnitude vis-a-vis your entire practice, this tends to be one of those things that does sometimes happen.
Got it.
Okay.
How are we doing on time?
Thank you. I think this is it. I'll let you sum up, and then we can greet as you walk out the door.
Maybe just so I just on page 14. I mean, check out our track record. It is very good. It's almost 16% on a net basis. So we're very proud that we do that. On page 15, this is a pretty standard term sheet for one of our separate accounts. What I would draw your attention to is that, as we've communicated to the staff, we are going to offer the entire program management fee on investment capital, not on committed capital. The intent there is to eliminate the J-curve, and this is a departure from the way private equity is typically priced. So we want your business, we want to be partnered with you, and we believe we put forward an aggressive fee proposal to get there, and we hope you'll strongly consider us.
So explain just real quick the fee on the commingled portion. The co-investment portion is a little higher, I think it was 10%. That's a carry?
That's a carry.
Yeah, okay, that's a 10% carry.
That's correct.
But that's only on committed. Am I hearing that right? That's
it's only on invested. It's on invested.
It's a performance fee.
Performance, back and loaded performance.
Okay. But everything else would be on invested capital.
Correct.
That's okay. Absolutely right, yes.
Which is sort of like how our real estate.
Carry only kicks in if we do well.
Okay.
And I think, I mean, just to reiterate, I mean, BlackRock is a big, stable fiduciary. This is an established business for us. You know, it's an area that we are eager to grow. We've been running these separate accounts for some very, very big state pension programs, peers of yours, for a long time. This is not new ground for us. And, you know, again, we thank you for bringing this in today to present, and we hope you'll come along with us.
Thank you. That, no last questions, Tim? Well, okay. Thank you. What you can do is, as we leave, you can come around and meet Narcisse if you wish, or give a card or
whatever. Yeah, we're running a little bit more. We still have.